Hello, folks. Welcome to the premium edition of the Labor Relations Information Systems podcast series. My name is Will Aitchison, and today I'll be interviewing Peter Brown. Peter is a partner in the management side law firm of Liebert Cassidy and Whitmore. You may have heard me talk about Liebert Cassidy and Whitmore over the years. It is, in my judgment, the premier public sector management side law firm in California. And not only just in California, I think they're one of the best management side firms in the country. I've had the pleasure over the years of being involved in different capacities with both partners and associates from Liebert Cassidy, sometimes handling cases against them. Sometimes they've served as speakers at LRIS seminars. And I can tell you, they have been uniformly first-rate lawyers. Peter's background is an interesting one. He's been with the firm for 30 years now. He started doing litigation, handling administrative hearings, disciplinary cases, and the like. And he very quickly moved into a position where he was doing a lot of Fair Labor Standards Act litigation in federal court. And then over time, over the last decade or so, and we'll talk about this a little bit, his practice has changed to the point where he's spending most of his days at the bargaining table, representing cities and counties and special districts in negotiations. He has become the chair of Liebert Cassidy's Labor Relations and Wage and Hour Practice Groups. That gives him all sorts of responsibilities for training new attorneys and providing continuing education for the firm's experienced attorneys. He also does a lot of external training for the firm's clients. He's published numerous articles, and he authored the CPER Guide to the Family and Medical Leave Act and the updates to it that have been published since 1997. Before I get into the interview, a word about CPER. The acronym stands for California Public Employee Relations. This is a series of publications. It's a resource, basically. That is provided by the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at the University of California in Berkeley. They issue a number of these public or pocket guides, everything from disciplinary action to collective bargaining to arbitration, layoff rules, and, of course, a variety of different federal and state statutes. These guides, the CPNR guides, are kept up to date by Berkeley. They're relatively inexpensive. They usually run under $30 a piece. So if you're looking for a handy pocket guide to something like, for example, the California Peace Officer Bill of Rights, Bills of Rights, the Firefighter Bill of Rights, or the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights, or you're looking for a guide to a federal statute, such as the FMLA, check out cper.berkeley.edu, and you'll be able to shop for the pocket guides there. And now, with no further ado, let's get to the interview. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning.
Peter, I was thinking back when I was preparing for this, when you and I were first introduced to each other, and I'd like to tell our listeners my best Peter Brown story, which is our introduction, if that's acceptable.
Of course.
Okay. So once upon a time, I was doing a seminar in Las Vegas, and I was doing a presentation on the Fair Labor Standards Act, and there were some firefighters there. They'll go unnamed because I don't want to identify anybody's client here. They'll go unnamed, and they listened attentively, and they got in touch with me afterwards, and they said, Are you really serious about the way the overtime rate should be calculated, that we need to be including these things in the overtime rate? And I said, yeah. You want me to write you a letter? And they said, sure. So I wrote them a letter and said, this is how I think the overtime rate should be calculated. And then I didn't hear anything more from them for about, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that. And they called me up and said, we got it settled. and this was the president of the union. He said, I was playing golf with the fire chief, and we worked it out somewhere around the eighth hole. And so everything is just fine. Our guys are going to get a bunch of back pay, and we're all happy. And then a couple of weeks after that, Peter, you called me, and you said that you had been consulted by the employer, and you wanted to let me know that you disagreed with how I interpreted the FLSA. And you and I had about, if I remember right, a 30-minute conversation about it, with, you know, when we were flinging federal regulation numbers and all that sort of stuff at me. And we ended up with neither of us convincing the other, probably not surprising there, but I ended up with a real profound respect for you. You didn't have any skin in the game. You know, your client had gone ahead and settled the case. This was not ongoing litigation. You just really wanted to find out what was ticking in my head and to correct the error of my ways and do it in a very professional way. And I loved it. I thought it was great. It was wonderful.
You know, the FLSA is also one of my loves. I know we're going to talk about a labor relations topic here today, but the Fair Labor Standards Act is one of those areas that when I came into the practice of law after law school in 1989, I sort of took the reins from John Liebert, who started our law firm and who was there at the beginning of the FLSA being applicable to the public sector in 1986. And you know, today, even 30 years later, I chair our firm's wage and hour practice group. And it's still one of those loves I have, and most people don't understand it because it's confusing as heck, but we're still practicing it. We're still dealing with it in litigation. I'm still advising our clients on it regularly. There's new regulations on the exact topic you were just talking about to come out. And we're ready to advise all of our clients about all the changes that'll mean, and it'll be a big deal change for a lot of public agencies all over the country.
Yeah, the FLSA, it's an odd statute. I share your love for it and the intricacies and sometimes the illogic of the FLSA. And I think there's probably, unless I'm wrong about this, there's probably about six of us in the country who share this love for the FLSA.
No doubt. Yeah.
So Peter, tell us a little bit about Liebert Cassidy and Whitmore, when the firm was created and how many lawyers and offices you have.
So the firm started in 1980, and we had a Los Angeles office and a little tiny little satellite office in San Francisco. Today we have five offices. We also have Fresno, San Diego, and Sacramento now, and our San Francisco office is much bigger, and so is our Los Angeles office. I was the 11th lawyer in the firm back in when I came to the firm in 1989. I mean, I was actually the summer clerk in 88, but when I started after law school in 89, I was the 11th lawyer, and today we have about 95 lawyers. And so, and you know, our practice is mostly representing public sector, public agencies. We've developed a little bit of a private school practice, but it's mostly representing public agencies. And my practice has been exclusively in the public sector for my entire 30 or 31 years, if you include that summer, and working with. For me, it's been all sorts of public, all sorts of employees, but a real focus for me has been working with public safety employees and in both labor relations and in wage and hour work.
And Peter, in the introduction that I pre-recorded for you, I described your personal practice as undergoing an interesting transition from more of a litigation mode to more of a presence at the bargaining table. How did that come about?
So, you know, I'll just tell you, so I remember when I first got into the practice of law and I was just getting started, even before I got to the firm, someone asked me what side I wanted to be on. And I said, very honestly, I didn't know. And so I fell into Liebert and loved working in government and loved working with the people in government. And so you know, what happened for me is, like a lot of lawyers, you start off working in, it's a labor and employment firm, and I started doing mostly employment work. And since there was such a few of us here, I became sort of an expert in like most of the things that we did at the firm. And as we got larger and larger, it became more difficult to do that. But I became a litigator. I mean, I would run litigation teams on big FLSA cases. I had an FLSA case for the city of Los Angeles, and that started, I got it in 1997. We had 10,000 plaintiffs in the case. And I had about 12 lawyers working under me. And as my, you know, as I got older and I watched the people who really started the firm, John Liebert and Dan Cassidy and Dick Whitmore, all of whom transitioned their careers into more of labor attorneys. And I started doing more labor negotiations. And I actually went to my first bargaining session 29 years ago with John Liebert. And one of the things that sort of attracted me to that type of work was that the lawyer part, when you think of lawyers, you think of people who are in battle, think people who are in cases, the winning and the losing of cases. What I love about collective bargaining and the labor relations portion of what a labor and employment lawyer does is it's not that at all. It's problem solving. It's working with people to understand why they feel differently than your client does, and recognizing that we're in a marriage that has no divorce, and that solving problems and reaching agreements is more important than fighting. And that has, as I've gotten older, that has sort of attracted me more so than fighting. The last case that I handled went to the California Supreme Court, and I was so done with fighting that I allowed the other attorney who was working with me on the case to handle the argument. I said, this is your case. I said, you've worked it up, I've supervised you, and this is your opportunity. Go ahead and make the argument at the Supreme Court. And I've never argued at the California Supreme Court. Court of Appeal, I can't even tell you how many times. Many, many, many times. But it had sort of slowly transitioned me into, I slowly transitioned into more of someone who enjoys that. And, you know, also as a parent, I find the labor relations it has some overlap to being a parent in the sense that, you know, your children are people who have differences in terms of how they look at the world, in terms of the things that they like about the world, and you reach compromises. And it's similar to marriage as well. And so I really have enjoyed that. And I have the utmost respect for police officers and firefighters and anyone who works in the public safety world. So, you know, my style in the collective bargaining table and in collective bargaining is, you know, I'm not that management hack jerk that comes in and makes everybody crazy. I sometimes deal with people like that, but I really try to just be collaborative and work within the system that we have, which is a tough system. And I've been successful in reaching agreements all over the place. And I am in so many collective bargaining negotiations at any given time that it's hard to keep up with all of them. But my demeanor and my approach to all of them is the same, which is collaborative.
And I've got to say, Peter, you plucked at a lot of strings there in my heart as well. And I've grown to think over time that the reason that I like being at the bargaining table so much is because of relationships and two kinds of relationships. To be sure, there are the personal relationships that you build with people on your team and the personal relationships you build with people on the other side of the table as well. But then there is the organizational relationship. And we have to keep in mind at all times when we're sitting at the bargaining table that this relationship is going to endure after we are gone. And it is our job to facilitate that relationship within the constraints of what our clients want, of course, to facilitate it and not to do anything to harm it because of our personal views or our personal wishes. And it's that focus on relationships to me and that somehow makes this just a wonderful practice to have.
I agree. I agree. Representing municipal governments, one of the things I can tell you is that their interests vary greatly from legislative bodies who are very, very conservative to legislative bodies who are very, very pro-labor. And my job is the same. That is, I want what they want, and I advocate for them, and I do it in a way that, again, facilitates and helps that relationship. So when I leave that table, I have not harmed that relationship.
Let me ask you a question. I know we're off on sort of a long aside here to start this podcast, but
sure.
I'm very curious about something. Earlier this week, there was a major study released by PERF, the Police Executive Research Forum, which I think of as kind of the big city police department, police chief think tank in Washington, D.C. And the study reviewed the responses of 250 PERF members about what it referred to as the police recruitment and retention crisis. And just detailed, you know, how this is a crisis that is facing law enforcement agencies, big and large, city, county, state law enforcement agencies, rural, urban, all over the country, were finding this recruitment and retention crisis. And PERF identified really three facets of it. First of all, a recruitment issue. We can't recruit the people that we want to recruit, and certainly not in the numbers that we expect to recruit them. And that means we're having, in part, to change standards on recruitment. The second is police officers aren't being retained in the way they used to in the future. We're starting to see things, PERF said, that we never used to see. We're starting to see police officers leaving employment before their retirement age, and not just to go to other law enforcement agencies, but sometimes simply abandoning the profession. And the third challenge that we have is we are now at the end of a hiring bubble that is about to pop, the hiring bubble that began under the Clinton administration. Those people who were hired then are now on the edge of retirement. And I'm wondering if you could tell us, because I know you keep your finger on the pulse of public safety bargaining throughout California. How is this issue playing out at the bargaining table down in California?
Oh my gosh, is it playing out at the bargaining table? So when I sit across the table from a labor association of maintenance workers, the issue is, are we paying a fair wage? The issue is, how are we paying compared to a marketplace? And how are we paying compared to the other employees in the agency? But the issues of recruitment and retention don't really exist. Yes, people leave. People leave agencies because sometimes you need to leave to promote. People leave agencies for personal reasons because their families move. That happens in every sector of public sector. But in law enforcement, it's completely different. With fire, and I'll explain why in a minute, with fire, I have some of my clients who will have thousands of people show up to take a test for 10 vacancies. But in law enforcement, it's different. And with law enforcement, what's happening is everything you said is definitely coming across the table to me. And then what happens is this, and this is the tough part for so many of my clients. In Southern California in particular, where I do most of the bargaining, the differences between the agencies in terms of affluence is in some cases dramatic. You have communities with average prices of homes in excess of $1 million, and you have other communities where the average price of a home is one quarter of that. And the marketplace is competing for a finite number of people. There are recruitments for police officers which are going unfilled, and agencies, so many of my clients, when you look at how many sworn they have on today, that number is 10%, 20% less than they had 10 years ago. Now, the population is continuing to grow in California, and so it's not like the population is shrinking, so we need less police officers, but either they're in a constant recruitment mode, or they've made a conscious decision that based on the cost of government in terms of what they are willing and able to provide in terms of the various services that they provide, that they're going to roll with less. And so what the difficulty that I face at the collective bargaining table on this one is that at those tables where the agency is not at the top of the market or close to the top of the market, the threat of people leaving is real. It's not just hyperbole. It's not just things that are said at the table. That's real. And the associations roll out the statistics to me about how many people during the term of this MOU left. And we hear about how much it costs to train somebody and how much it costs to have someone leave. And you have, I just read an article just the other day of an agency in the middle of the state, Seaside, California, offering large bonuses for people to, signing bonuses for people to come. Now, all of that, everything that you said, Will, is all sort of part of the equation of the dialogue that goes on at the collective bargaining table with police officers. And it's, in some respects for my clients, it's sort of like almost like a vicious cycle. And what I mean by that is, as one agency in the mix does something really good for their police officers, gives them a really nice raise, the result is that it reverberates throughout the community without being specific as to a particular table that I'm at right now. It's a county, okay, with sheriffs. And we've been at this table for over a year. And very recently, another county close by gave a very healthy increase to their sheriffs for all the reasons of needing to recruit, needing to retain, needing to be able to provide quality public law enforcement service to the community that they serve. And the minute that happened, it just completely changes the dynamic of the collective bargaining at this other county that I'm actually at the table at. So yes, it is a big deal. And I don't purport to be an expert into why this has happened, but some of the things that have been described to me are the advent of cell phone videos and cameras has shown us a lot of videos on television of law enforcement doing something that they perhaps shouldn't be doing, and it has caused some people to second guess going into that career. I don't, whatever the reason is, okay, whatever the reason is, the reality is, I get X thousands of people show up for a firefighter's exam, and agencies struggle to hire police officers. So that is an absolute reality in my labor world.
And that, of course, puts pressure on sort of the old adage that used to be around of police fire parity. You've just got different labor markets for the two positions now.
You're right. And I would say to you, my experience continues to be that fire continues to want to receive the same that police receives. I see with fire, the one change that I see is that more agencies are considering contracting their fire service to a larger fire organization because of the nature of fire service. In Southern California, or California generally, we have a lot of wildland fires, and when that occurs, the fire service is all about the whole fire service. Whereas with law enforcement, it's mostly protecting your local jurisdiction, and so more and more agencies are going in that direction, and I don't see much of that happening in law enforcement. A lot of agencies in law enforcement, or most agencies in law enforcement, see the value in maintaining their local police officers and deputy sheriffs as something that is more beneficial than having somebody who hasn't worked in the community. But But as far as how it's changed at the table, I've seen some of that will, meaning I've seen some agencies willing to provide more to their police officers than they've offered to their firefighters. But, you know, the firefighters still are a very strong and powerful subset of our public safety services. And mostly, I would say, because of the life and death that they save us from in terms of the medical aid services that they provide. And of course, in addition to look at California. I mean, I was driving back from a meeting last November and seeing the hills in my distance burning. And one of my fellow negotiators on the other, police negotiators on the other side of the table lost his house to a fire. I mean, it's real. I mean, we need these services for sure, but I don't think the knock, the publicity that, the negative publicity that law enforcement has gotten has really come to fire. I haven't seen that. And so there seemingly is a lot more people that are continuing interested to be in the fire service than, and less people are dropping out of the fire service than the police service. That's been my experience.
Well, we had better get on track here. Okay. But before we do, there is something about Liebert Cassidy that I've always sort of admired from afar. And I think you guys do better than any other firm I've seen in the country. And that's your training consortium. Will you tell us how it works?
Yeah. So this was the brainchild of John Liebert, who started our firm. And essentially what it is this. We have, I don't know the exact number, but it's around 35. We have 35 of these training consortiums. And what they are is this. Agencies who are geographically close to each other in terms of proximity. So you may have 10 agencies, 15 agencies, 20 agencies, 40 agencies who all are in the same area. They might be in a particular county. They may be in a particular region. Pay our firm an annual fee. And for that annual fee, they get 5 full days of training, which is usually broken up into 3 full days and 4 half days. So it's 5 full days, however it's broken up. And in addition to that, they get all of our firm's publications, and then they have the ability to call into our firm and also ask questions of our lawyers, not like document reviews, but questions about the law. Hey, AB5 was signed yesterday. What can you tell me about that? Hey, I have this discipline problem with this employee, and here's what we're doing. What do you think about that? You know, typical lawyer consultations, all built into that annual fee, which is fairly low. And a lot of agencies utilize the consortium call service or email service a lot. But the training service is great because there's no limit. Meaning that if you join our consortium as a public agency, you can send 50 people to our trainings. And we have, you know, trainings that run the gamut of managers, supervisors would be interested in knowing to be better managers and supervisors in the area of labor and employment. And so that consortium process or the consortiums have really grown over the years. We have hundreds of consortium members, and like I said, 35 of these consortiums, and each year it seems like another 10 agencies, 15 agencies join the consortium, and very few drop out because it's a real value to them.
It's just fascinating to me, and I have emphasized throughout my career the importance of training and knowledge about what the law is. And I think you do the best job of that on the management side of anybody out there.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about the oddity that is California public sector bargaining law. I have tried from time to time to count how many state statutes there are for public sector bargaining in California. I think I end up with 7. Is that count right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, there's going to be a baby born in California soon. I don't know exactly when that baby is going to be born, but that baby is going to be the 40 millionth citizen of our state. Okay, we're right on the cusp right now. And with 40 million people in our state, we're bigger than most countries. And so we have a lot of public employees. And those public employees work at a variety of agencies that are different. And the nuances and differences between, for example, state employees and school, public school and community college employees and employees who work for the courts has caused some differences between our collective bargaining laws. The ones that in my career that I've been involved in are what's called the Myers-Milius-Brown Act, which is the law that impacts local government, like cities and counties and special districts, like water districts and mosquito abatement districts and all these different types of districts we have, irrigation districts in California. There's a lot of them. And then the other one that I've been very involved in my career, not so much now as a few years ago, was what's called the Educational Employment Relations Act, ERA, E-E-R-A, which is the same law as the Myers-Milius-Brown Act, except it's for schools and community colleges. And there are some differences between the laws. I mean, the funding sources of these agencies are different. I mean, you take a city, for example, whose primary sources of revenue are tax revenues and revenues that they get from parking fees. And then you take a school or a community college who gets, you know, their revenue source from the state, you know, from the state's budget. And so it's a different type of revenue source. And that changes the dynamic in collective bargaining because, like, for example, there have been a handful of cities, two of whom I bargained for in the last year, whose police officers went to bat for sales tax revenue measures, where they raised the sales tax by a half a cent or a cent, and the result is that has caused those agencies to be able to provide more to their police officers or provide more police officers that is utilizing those dollars for those purposes. Schools and colleges don't have that. I mean, so the dynamics in terms of the revenue sources are different, and so that has sort of helped in defining why there are different collective bargaining laws in California.
Now, it's the Myers-Milius-Brown Act, or MMBA, as you guys call it,
yep.
That covers most public safety employees in California, right?
Right, that's right.
Now, beyond the MMBA, there are some jurisdictions that bargain under their own ordinances or charter provisions. How
right.
did that happen?
So first of all, I mean, the MMBA is a state law that went into effect exactly 50 years ago in 1969. So most of the agencies, there are 483 cities in California and 58 counties, and I don't know the number of special districts, but a lot. Most of them bargain under the state laws. But we have this thing in California where we have the ability for cities to operate under a city charter rather than to be what's called a general law city. As I mentioned, we have 483 cities, and of those 483 cities, 86 of them, so about one-fifth of them, are charter cities. And charter cities, and some of the largest cities in California are charter cities: Los Angeles, San Diego, Sacramento, San Jose, San Francisco. Those are all charter cities. And a charter city, or a city that operates under a charter, has a special thing about it that's unique. I don't know about the other states, but in California, it means that if you adopt your own charter, then the agency could adopt procedures for matters that are considered municipal affairs. And then under the California Constitution, our state constitution, it grants charter cities the power to make and enforce ordinances and resolutions with respect to these municipal affairs. It's in the California Constitution in Article 11. And so this is, over the years, has been referred to as something called the Home Rule, and the Home Rule is deals with municipal affairs that the agency has the ability to decide for their own, and that has included things like dealing with municipal employees on matters related to bargaining. And so what's happened over the years with respect to laws like the Myers-Milius-Brown Act and the California constitutional provision on the home rule is there's been a whole lot of cases dealing with whether this particular component to the state law is applicable to a charter city or not. And in fact, there have been some attempts, not a lot, but one particular, which I won't mention the name of the agency, but I will tell you, there's one agency out there who sought really hard to become a charter city. They had to have an election to have a charter city. And the logic behind it is that if they became a charter city, they'd have more local control over municipal affairs per this home rule process. And so it sort of kind of goes back in time as to how the agencies sort of organized themselves a long time ago as to whether an agency is a charter city. It could still become a charter city, but to become a charter city, you have to put that out to the electorate. And in the particular case of this one agency that tried, this one city that tried to become a charter city, organized labor fought it. And organized labor was successful, as I understand, in that election failing, and the result is that that city is still a general law city. And I'm not aware of other cities who have tried to become charter cities. This is something that has got, that they became charter cities a long time ago. So yeah, you do have some agencies, local agencies, not a lot. I mean, you have some of the bigger cities like Los Angeles, for example, that operates under its own ordinance. And I personally, I negotiate for both charter and general law cities, but I haven't worked within the ordinance process. That is, I haven't worked for an agency who isn't subject to the Myers-Milius-Brown Act. Some of our lawyers, some of my partners have, and if they do, but I will say this: I do work for one agency who has a charter and who's adopted interest arbitration to resolve its labor dispute, which is different than state fact-finding, which I'm sure I'll talk about here. And that, by having done that, that really is a significant difference in terms of how bargaining ultimately resolves, because interest arbitration is a process with, like a case, like I was telling you about before, it sort of ends with a winner and a loser, whereas, you know, the bargaining process ends with a decision of who wins the decision, and whereas fact-finding, which is the end process of our state Myers-Milius-Brown Act, is just a recommendation to the legislative body who has the choice of, you know, to completely ignore the recommendation. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about this, but that's part of the, and actually let me talk about that right now if it's okay. Talk about the sort of the dynamics of the labor process. So let's talk about for a minute here, the tools and the toolbox of both labor and management as it relates to our law here. So the tools and the toolbox of labor are, they have a lot of influence, the ability to influence elected officials, both in terms of who gets elected to office by supporting candidates, by putting pressure on the agency in terms of who they'll support or supporting existing candidates, by speaking out to the public about the services that they provide and why it's necessary to have good quality public employees providing the services, especially, well, I don't want to say especially in law enforcement and fire, it's really in all services, but in particular in law enforcement and fire. And so those tools, and of course the ultimate tool of strikes and job actions, picketing, and other things that are done. I mean, I've been in several a city council meeting where you can actually hear the employees outside the closed session doors, you know, either picketing or marching or doing something that to try to influence the decision to reach an agreement. And so those are tools that exist in labor's toolbox, and management knows that, and you know, that's why we try to work towards an agreement so that we're not actually having to deploy the tools in our toolbox. But the ultimate tool that management has, even under fact-finding law, is that the end result is, if you go all the way through the process and you don't reach an agreement, is a fact-finding. And fact-finding, our law in California is pretty standard of what fact-finding is, you know, a three-party panel hears both sides and its position with respect to the bargaining. And the three-party panel is one from labor, one from management, and then a neutral, and that, then they make an advisory recommendation to the legislative body. And it's generally the neutral whose decision it is, because the management's rep typically sides with management, and labor's rep typically sides with labor. But then in the end, it's advisory. And many of a legislative body looks at the advisory recommendation as no third party is going to tell us how we should spend our money. And so what we're going to do is impose what we were willing to provide as our last, best, and final offer. And what I typically or often hear at the collective bargaining table from labor on that is that it's a baseball game where you get to decide who wins. It's not a baseball game where the umpires decide. It's a baseball game where, in the end, we can battle it out, go to the bottom of the ninth, go into extra innings, and then in the bottom of the 14th, the employer can say, it's our way. We win the game. And so, you know, in some respects, that's true, in the sense that that is the law. But it's very difficult for any employer to impose an offer on a labor association because of because of what it does to the relationship, and because it's hard feelings, it's morale busting, it's not anything that anyone wants in the process. And so when I go through this process, Will, I spend more time trying to convince my clients, the legislative bodies, who are oftentimes way more difficult for me to deal with than the labor associations who are sitting in front of me. So sometimes I have three clients, three adversaries, so to speak. The labor association is sitting in front of me, my legislative body, who I have to convince, and sometimes the clients who I'm working with, the HR staff or the managers or administrators from the police or fire department who may be sitting there at the table with me, who may have a different opinion on what we should do from an economic standpoint. So all that stuff is what I love about this process, because it all comes down to problem solving and understanding that sometimes an agreement is way more important than feeling right that you got this one and they got that one. It's more important to get an agreement and you can live with some compromises that you thought you couldn't live with. So that's been my experience.
So focusing on this basic process you've described, sure. Negotiations, mediation, then fact-finding, we'll carve out for a moment those that have interest arbitration under the sure. local charter, because there's very few of them.
Right, exactly.
Do those processes also apply to midterm changes in mandatorily negotiable topics, like hours of work or something like that?
So that actually happened by two cases that came out in California at the same time. I think it was 2015. And what happened was the state fact-finding law went into effect in 2013, and many of my clients took the position that this only applies if we get to an impasse in a bargaining over a successor MOU. But these two cases, which came out within a couple of weeks of each other, both ruled the same way. One was, I believe, for San Diego's Housing Commission. I think another one was for Riverside County. And they both ruled that, yes, the fact-finding provision applies even to midterm issues on anything. I could be negotiating over a job description, and we can say, hey, we'd like to change this job description, and the labor association can say, okay, well, the impact of that is going to mean that this is a more important job, so we want a 3% wage increase because this job actually now has more responsibility. And we can say, no, we want to give it 2%, and they can say, no, we want 3%, and in the end, we can go to fact-finding over that. And so these midterm issues, work schedule changes, modifications to a special assignment pay, or anything else that we deal with that ultimately end in an impasse could actually go through fact-finding as a result of that case law.
And Let's talk about one other feature of the MMBA before we dive into these, or it started off being one Orange County case we're going to talk about. I guess we're now going to talk about two because we got a new decision a couple weeks ago.
Sure.
The one other feature of the MMBA, the state bargaining law, it contains a number of different unfair labor practices. It lists them on behalf of both the employer and the union. If you do this, then that's an unfair labor practice.
Right.
Well,
right.
What is the agency that resolves those claims of unfair labor practices?
So that agency is called the Public Employment Relations Board, PERB. And PERB are five people, all appointed by the governor. Okay. And their responsibility is to do exactly what you just said. They're sort of like an appellate court for unfair labor practice, but they're an administrative agency. And so they operate, they have offices throughout the state. They operate with by hearing unfair labor practice charges, utilizing an administrative law judge to hear the charge and then issue a decision. And then ultimately that decision is appealable to this board. Now, think about this board, which is fascinating, is that they're effectively political appointees. And what I mean by that is that the governor at the time decides who goes on this PERB board. One of the Liebert Cassidy Whitmore attorneys is now on the PERB board. His name is Eric Shiners. He was an attorney with us until sometime last year when Governor Brown appointed him to the PERB board. And since Governor Newsom has been on the PERB board, I think he's either appointed one or two folks to the PERB board. And some of the decisions that have recently come out of PERB have really shown stark differences of opinion in terms of interpreting the Myers-Mills-Brown Act on a couple of areas, and I've seen some more dissenting opinions on some of these PERB decisions. And so the dynamic in terms of how it's changed for my clients in California is that I have to tell my clients now, you have a very pro-employee PERB board right now. And so ultimately, if an unfair practice charge is filed and it gets to PERB, it is more likely than not that you're going to get an unfavorable decision because the interpretation of the law is being done by people who are appointed by the governor, who's very, very pro-employee in terms of his feelings about organized labor and his feelings about labor generally. So, you know, we have to work our way through that. And we also have tons of cases interpreting what is an unfair labor practice. And it's fairly broad in terms of what's in the scope of bargaining. And so PERB hears that stuff, and we are aware of the fact that, you know, PERB is very much right now a pro-employee organization.
Now, Peter, what you might describe as an unfavorable opinion or pro-employee, I might describe as thoughtful. There's the possibility of that.
It might be. I hear you.
But that aside, one of the things I do is I try to read all of the opinions from all public sector labor boards in the country.
Wow.
Put read in quotes, right? I mean,
okay.
I scan them, and if they're of interest, I'll actually read them.
Okay.
And I can say a couple of things about PERB's decisions compared to, for example, the whatever it might be, the Labor Relations Board in Pennsylvania or PERC up in Washington. The first thing is your PERB seems almost incapable of writing an opinion that is less than 50 pages long.
You're
and
right.
And secondly, your administrative law judges who write these opinions before they get to PERB, and then PERB sits as an appellate body, have a preternatural love for the footnote. It is not uncommon to see 100 footnotes in these opinions. And I've got to tell you, as an outsider, although, you know, because of the fact I represent unions. I kind of like the way PERB is ruling in a lot of these cases.
Sure.
I take a deep breath before I read a PERB opinion because I know I'm going to be in for a slog. What is it about your system that produces that?
Well, I'm not sure I know, but I'll just say this, Will, and that is that our system has major flaws in it because it's not funded well enough. And here's what I mean. We're a state that's about to have our 40 millionth person living in it. And the ALJ process and the PERB process is a process that takes an extraordinarily long time. And because of that, the process is not really a process that can be used to move along a labor process. If you're a labor union and you feel that there has been an unfair practice of something that has occurred at the table, there has been a bad faith bargaining or a regressive bargaining, which is, you know, going backwards in place in terms of a totality of the circumstances, or an employer is engaging in dilatory tactics, you know, delaying the process, whatever the case may be. If you file an unfair practice charge, it goes through a process here in California that before it even would get to a hearing in front of an administrative law judge, it can take 2 years. And as you know, this process of trying to move the labor negotiations along, it can't wait 2 years. People need to get their increases, the cost of living is rising, and so while the process that exists here, it exists, and yes, we are bogged down with footnotes, I don't know why, okay, but I do know that it makes the negotiations part that much more important because we don't have a net. We don't have a safety net here. Yes, you can always file an injunction. Injunctions exist, but injunctions are not for unfair practice charges. They are for things that need an immediate resolution, which is virtually nothing that has to do with the labor relations process. And so we're sort of out here in the labor world here without anybody to resolve our disputes, unless we want to get an answer 3 years from now, in which case we'll be long beyond these labor negotiations. And so that makes our job at the table that much more important because we don't have a referee. We don't have an umpire. We don't have anyone to call on the phone and say, hey, they did something bad. Can you come in and help us? They can file an unfair practice charge, but it's not going to be resolved for a long time. And that makes our job that much more important because in the end, we might wind up with a big delay in the process, and that doesn't help anybody.
And Peter, I did not know the length of that delay, but a 2-year delay to me is just simply appalling. And not just, you talk about bargaining cases, yeah, a 2-year delay in a process where simply by filing a ULP complaint, one side or the other can hold up the entire bargaining, perhaps intentionally, who knows, or the bargaining is just simply held up by virtue of the law. I mean, that seems absolutely crazy, but it's not just bargaining cases. I mean, you could have, for example, an anti-union animus decision that where an employer acted inappropriately, retaliated against someone for union activity, that might strike at the core of the union's ability to represent its members and union's credibility with its members, and that thing will sit out there for 2 years and fester.
Yep.
And this is not a good situation. Why have management and labor locked arms and gone to the legislature and said we need more money?
I haven't seen it, no.
Well, I don't understand that. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about PERB's jurisdiction over public safety employees.
Sure.
Has PERB always had jurisdiction over police officers and firefighters?
No. So, first of all, the Myers-Milius-Brown Act has been on the books, as I said, for 50 years. PERB has only had jurisdiction over local government since 2001. There was a statute of 2000 that went into effect in 2001. But when that statute went into effect, that is that PERB, you can now file unfair practice charges with PERB, the understanding from the statute, the interpretation of the statute, was that it didn't apply to law enforcement. Applied to fire, not law enforcement. So if a law enforcement association or employee wanted to file something alleging that the Myers-Briggs Act had been violated, they had to do it by actually filing a court action. We call it a writ of mandate in California, which is just a way to get into a superior court to allege that a statute has been violated. And so it wasn't until 2015 where we started to see the PURB address this in a case involving, I think it was Santa Clara.
Santa Clara County.
Yeah, Santa Clara County, yeah. Now, what was interesting about that decision, okay, the Santa Clara decision, is that there's actually language in that decision that says, we make explicit PURB's authority to hear charges that are brought by employee organizations, including employee organizations representing or seeking to represent units, including persons who are peace officers. Now, that's a quote out of the Santa Clara decision. But what's interesting about the Santa Clara decision is Santa Clara County involved what's called a mixed unit. Now, a mixed unit is a police association who represents both sworn and non-sworn. So you might have your police officers and your sergeants in the association, but you may also have records and dispatch and forensics and other safety support type classifications that might be in there, or even correctional deputies if you're in a county that you know are non-safety employees. Now, since 2015, we've seen, you know, we've all sort of understood PURB's position, which is that they have jurisdiction over mixed units. But that quote that I just read was actually in the decision, and I remember the special bulletin our law firm put out in 2015 about the County of Santa Clara case and saying, you know, this quote could very easily be what PURB relies on for the conclusion that they have jurisdiction over a non-mixed unit, just a complete sworn unit of law enforcement, just police officers and sergeants, for example, or police officers, corporals and sergeants, any classifications that are just sworn classifications. And that's exactly what happened recently in July.
Now, let's talk about the before here.
Sure.
Back in the days when everybody seemed to be on the same page, that PURB had no jurisdiction over police officer bargaining units and these bargaining disputes. Let's take your like a garden variety unilateral change case.
Sure.
Let's say the employer wakes up one morning and says, you know, I'm tired of these 4/10s.
Correct.
I'm in a change to 5/8s.
Yep.
And there's, you know, there may or may not be contract language that may or may not be a waiver and all that. But the union wants to say, hey, you can't do that unilaterally. You got to give us notice, and you're going to have to meet and confer with us.
Right.
And go through the bargaining process. So before we have all of these developments in the case law, if I understand you right, the union would have to go to court by filing a writ of mandate with a local superior court. Is that right?
Yep, that's exactly right.
Now I don't know much about trial court judges in the state of California, and actually using the word much is a great overstatement. I know nothing about trial court judges. But I do know state trial court judges in some other states. And the notion of dumping a bargaining dispute on a trial court judge seems like a horrific proposition to me, in that you don't know what you're going to get out of that judge. Was that true in California as well?
Yeah, I mean it's a total crapshoot, no doubt. Okay, here's what I'll tell you as a result of that. Okay, what I will tell you is I didn't see that many of these kinds of filings. Okay, that is, without the ability to utilize an administrative process that's free, right? I mean, it's, you know, you don't need to be a lawyer to go to practice in front of PERB. Association can file a PERB charge one day. Without that, I didn't see a lot of lawsuits. Essentially, what wound up happening as before, you know, PERB has identified that it has jurisdiction over law enforcement, is law enforcement realized that utilizing the pressures and the tools in its toolbox to accomplish what it needs and wants to accomplish at the collective bargaining table, was those resources were better spent locally than it was spent trying to deal with it in court. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we have case law in California that's developed over time through Superior Court decisions that went to the Court of Appeal and that went to you know, even in some cases, the seminal Supreme Court case involving what's the scope of bargaining in California involving the city of Claremont. But it's it's few and far between. It's not a it's not something that I would regularly see. And I think the reason is as I mentioned, with FLSA, where we started this conversation, you file a lawsuit, okay? Now you're in federal court, you can get attorney's fees and liquidated damages, and it's the filing of the lawsuit is usually what motivates the settlement discussions. Filing a writ of mandate on an MMBA issue in Superior Court is not really going to facilitate a whole lot. I mean, it sort of like it was like a last resort, so to speak, and especially when you can accomplish a lot of what you're seeking to accomplish by just bargaining and putting the appropriate pressure on the local government agencies to accomplish what you want. And given law enforcement's power at the bargaining table and how important they are to the organization, that they provide such a valuable service to the local communities, they're more effective in that role than they are necessarily going to Superior Court.
So now we have in the last month, month and a half or so, these two Orange County decisions out of PERB. What's PERB saying in these cases?
Well, so let's just start with the seminal case on PERB's jurisdiction. So PERB said that, hey, folks, didn't you see what we said in the County of Santa Clara case? Which is, we have jurisdiction over associations that represent peace officers, okay? And so we weren't kidding back in 2015 when we issued the Santa Clara County case. Somebody may have read into the Santa Clara County case that we were only talking about mixed units. But we're not talking about mixed units. We're talking about actual, full-on, just sworn employees. Now, what's interesting about that case, that first one of the cases that you're talking about, is that the underlying issue that got brought to PERB was ultimately decided in the county's favor. Okay, the question which is really fairly narrow in scope is whether the county was obligated to bargain changes to some ordinance creating an office of independent review that advised the sheriff on certain in custody incidents and complaints against law enforcement personnel. And ultimately, PERB said no. The changes to that ordinance only concerned management's discretion to get direction from its legal counsel, and it had really nothing to do with the meet and confer requirements of the MMBA. So we had a sort of an interesting thing happen in that case, which is here's this huge case that comes out because it's the first time in 18 years since PERB's jurisdiction comes to municipal government, and we finally have a seminal case out of PERB saying it applies to law enforcement, solely sworn law enforcement bargaining units. But then in the end, the reason they filed the unfair practice charge, that is the association did, was something over something that PERB ultimately said is not subject to bargaining. So it's an interesting thing, but you know, we as the recipients of these decisions, meaning the parties, they have to deal with the actual outcome of the decision. We get the what does this mean for us? And the issue, the underlying issue about the ordinance, the Office of Independent Review Ordinance, I think very few agencies have that unless they're very large agencies. So, I mean, most of my clients don't have anything like that. And the underlying legal question about whether that was subject to bargaining, I haven't even heard of that before. I mean, I've never had that question asked of me in 30 years of practicing law. But the issue of public agency now having jurisdiction over law enforcement associations, that is a big change, because now that means that they can file unfair practice charges, and the common understanding since 2001 is that they couldn't. And so it changes the landscape.
And it's to me, that was sort of a fascinating result. Because the employer won, the employer couldn't appeal that part of the decision asserting jurisdiction over the case.
Right.
you can't appeal cases that you win because you don't like how you win them. It's a basic principle. But now we have Orange County too. And in Orange County too, we have not only the assertion of jurisdiction, but the employer lost that case, right?
Right. I mean, that was, the county revised its merit selection rules for selection related to certain types of employees. And, it deals with promotional opportunities, which I've continued to say is bargainable. And so, one of the questions you didn't ask me here, Will, and I know it, I could go on and on about it for hours, but I'll just mention it very briefly, is the question of what's subject to meet and confer. And the answer to that question is, I don't know. And the reason I say that is because it's like all these tests that come out of these courts on the totality of the circumstances, which is it better to bargain or is it better to allow the employer to make an independent decision without bargaining? That's essentially what the Claremont decision says. That is, in the public's interest, is it better that there's a meet and confer process? And the reason I say I don't know is I'm frequently asked the question of, do we have to bargain over this question? And I'm frequently answering the question, which is, I don't know of a case that says one way or the other, but here's why, based upon the totality of the circumstances, it's likely that you would get a ruling from PERB that says yes, and then I start to explain it. And so the reason I mention that is the Orange County, the second Orange County case that you're talking about that just came out very recently, deals with a subject which I can very easily see why an employer may believe and feel like the issue of selecting employees should not be subject to collective bargaining. But the flip side is that promotion is often how people are able to survive, because I didn't get into this business to retire just as a police officer. I want to work my way up. And yes, I want processes to allow me to move up in an organization that my labor association has the ability to influence through the bargaining process. So, I wasn't the attorney on any of these, but if you would ask me the question, where would I have come out on this decision? I would have come out that this decision is very predictable to me, not a surprise.
And let me bring my non-California view to all of this, the scope of bargaining issue.
Sure.
I watched when Claremont came out, and the language in Claremont from the Supreme Court, I think, is a pretty expansive reading of management rights. I could see it breathing hope into employers that there would be a number of decisions that would be entrepreneurial in nature that it would not have to bargain about. And then I have watched in the years since Claremont, as first of all, the California Supreme Court, and then later PERB in several decisions, has pretty much eroded, I think, pretty much everything to do with Claremont, except maybe the particular factual holding in the case.
Right.
And were I a lawyer representing an employer in California, And the client came to me with a scope of bargaining question. Is this negotiable?
Right.
I think my answer would be,
sure.
Who cares? Go ahead and bargain it.
Right.
You know, at the end of the process, if you can't reach an agreement, you're going to have the right to unilaterally implement.
Yep.
Why spend tens of thousands of dollars and years, you're now telling me, litigating whether or not this is a mandatory subject of bargaining?
You're right. You're right.
Okay.
You know, it's really funny, Will, I'll just tell you. If you go back to your childhood days and you think about the baseball you played on the field, there was nobody there to umpire it, and you just worked it out. That's what you got to do in bargaining.
Well, okay. Peter, do you know if Orange County is going to be appealing the jurisdictional
question? I don't. I don't know.
Well, we'll see very shortly on it.
Sure.
Peter, you've been incredibly generous with your time with us, and I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for participating in the podcast.
My great pleasure, Will. Thank you for asking me to help you.
And Peter, I got to get you back on the LRIS speaker schedule. I can tell that. I know I'm going to have to bribe you for that.
So I've
got to ask you, is it scotch or bourbon? Never mind.
Thanks, Will.
Okay, folks, that has been Peter Brown, a partner with the California law firm of Liebert, Cassidy, and Whitmore, weighing in on a bit broader subject than I think we started with, and talking generally about the state of public sector and public safety bargaining and negotiations in California. Thanks for listening. We hope that you join us for a future LRIS podcast. This is Will Aitchison signing off.